chaotic hellscape inhabited by mutos, dregs, primords. Field Major Steyr of the Sontaran Empire and the bandaged-faced traffic warden from Threads. You shelter below ground, waiting for rad levels to drop to safe levels. Alone, with nothing more than minimal food rations. And somewhat improbably, 5 stories from the Doctor Who universe in any medium. TV, audio, film, novel, comic book. These artifacts. They'll be your only link to the past. Maybe for the rest of your life. Welcome to The Bunker, a Doctor Who podcast from Cutaway Comics. Brought to you by Bamalan Productions. And now, here's your host, Ian Winterton.
Eating dog food and processing the horrors he's witnessed this week is Matt Badham, writer and journalist. He's penned features on everything from comics to climbing for Big Issue North, the Judge Dredd magazine, Comic Heroes, and the Forbidden Planet International blog, amongst many others, as well as a Future Shock for 2000 AD and a strip for Commando Picture Library. A huge Doctor Who fan, he's a big supporter of Cutaway, and his interview with myself and the boss, Gareth Cavanagh, is up now on John Freeman's brilliant downthetubes.net. Matt, welcome to the bunker. How's the apocalypse going so far?
It's all right, you know, it's not too bad. I haven't been reduced to eating human flesh yet, but it's only a matter of time. But I've always been a picky eater, you see. That's the
human flesh luxury. There's no dead bodies near me.
that introduction makes me sound far more ostentatious than I am, because I was reflecting on this when I sent over some details of what I've done. I've been remiss in not mentioning the excellent Red Eye by Barry Renshaw, who, funnily enough, was the artist on the...
Kickstarted Cutaway's journey off.
Yeah, and he started me off as well by giving me the opportunity to do interviews and features. And funnily enough, it was via one of those features, interviewing Matt Smith of 2000 AD, that I got in touch with Alan Barnes, then editor of the Judge Dredd magazine, and got my first ever professional commission, a feature on Small Press Comics in the magazine. And the other thing is, when I say ostentatious, I still, in a way, you know, it's very much been a side hustle. We'll see what happens after, you know, almost 20 years. But I very much see myself as a fanzine writer, but who makes a bit of money as well. But I don't see fanzine writers as a derogatory term. You only have to look at, for example, Link to Cutaway, Warp, to see the quality fanzines can have, you know.
Yeah. I've been reading your articles in the magazine on and off for however many thousands of years it is. When did you first write for the magazine?
2006. I did on Small Press Comics, then mostly interviews and features, and then I've had a bit of a break from writing. I was a teaching assistant working with children with additional needs, and even though I was only working 20 hours a week because of family commitments, I found that job actually drained pretty much all my energy.
Yeah, I've done quite a lot of working in a similar field.
And so I'm sort of getting back on the horse a bit now. I've started doing some more features for the magazine, and we'll see what happens.
Oh, cool, that's good. Yeah, because my my experience with the magazine, we'll go into your childhood soon in a psychiatric kind of way. But 2000 AD and then the magazine is kind of, it's been part of my childhood since I can remember, same as Doctor Who. And so my big period of the magazine is the 90s.
Yeah.
And then as all things, you sort of, I think the rebellion years of AD and Judge Dredd is when I've sort of stopped reading it very regularly, just sort of as naturally you do, the same way as I stopped watching Doctor Who constantly. But you kind of come back to these things as you're older, is what I'm finding. Things come and go, but when I was in my 20s, I was still a teenager in lots of ways who didn't miss an issue of anything, and it just gradually falls away as you go on. How did your sort of journey into comics begin? I mean, from childhood, I'm assuming.
Well, Well, my journey into comics really began that I read them, and they were just part of the firmament of the 70s and 80s. And I refer to both 2000 AD and Doctor Who as foundation myths for me. It's almost like being a lapsed Catholic, and then perhaps returning. I can remember 2000 AD was just like a creative explosion in my head. I can't. Returning to it in later years and still reading it now, I can't quite believe what I was reading. But I was reading about, I was an impressionable child and I was reading a boys' action adventure comic in which Judge Dredd annihilated a city with nuclear weapons. So it was really, I'd already read things like The Beano, and there was a comic called Spike, and then my sister's boyfriend talked about Judge Dredd in 2000 AD. And we started getting it. So I was reading it sort of 83, 84, 85, 86, that sort of mid 80s.
Yeah, same here. A little bit, but I inherited a tea chest from my cousin. My cousin kind of grew out of it. And grew out of Doctor Who almost sort of as he hit 10. He was suddenly just obsessed with being driving cars and football. And he so I got all his geeky stuff, which had just been a passing phase. So I got a tea chest full of Doctor Who weeklies and 2000 AD from like issue five. So I first so in the sort of mid 80s, I first bought it in 85. But then I had the back history of it. So I just remember going, what is this apocalypse war that I've read about the aftermath of? And then to go back right to the beginning and watch, almost to the beginning and just I just read them in order in that way. Just the Dread. I was, all the other stuff I wasn't as bothered by, but Dread, I just loved it instinctively. And the fact that it's I just love the fact that it isn't like Batman or Superman or Peanuts or The Simpsons. It changes in real time as it goes on. And for some reason, my geeky brain absolutely loved that fact. I always had a block on Spider-Man and Batman because they were forever just so nothing really happened in those universes because time had no meaning, if you know
There's
what I mean.
probably a very good feature to be written by someone who's far more intelligent about the iterative nature of both Doctor and Judge Dredd and do a comparison, because I see a lot of similarities between them. Superficially, one is a violent fascist super cop of the future, and one is a cosmic wanderer and good guy adventurer who is never cruel or cowardly, although occasionally he blows up planets. But the iterative nature, the fact
He's killed more people than Judge Dredd, let's be
and
honest.
then if you think at the very beginning, the creators, they had something and they didn't quite have a handle on it. It was quite different, The Doctor Who, as I like to call him, to annoy some. Now I'm being cruel. But anyway, the Doctor is a, curmudgeonly old man, is frightened, is on the run. Judge Dredd is this kind of hero, almost superheroic figure, because they've had to dial back from the authoritarian who kills people. And then as time went on, they built the worlds and change them, and you almost see them developing the concepts on the page and on the screen. And then similarly, there have been attempts made by creators to retrospectively weave the continuity in, the early continuity, not to deny it. So Doctor Who, which was a story, as we'll talk about, very much about this strange old man and his granddaughter on the run, becomes about how his exposure to his companions, Barbara and Ian, makes him a better individual and turns him into a hero. And likewise, Judge Dredd develops, it goes through a period where there's a big emphasis on the city and crimes, and the weirdness of the future. There's an early story, the first, not the first mega epic, but the Cursed Earth, in which Pat Mills makes him overtly a hero. And then after that, they start to grapple with this contradiction. And really, once John Wagner's back on board as the main writer, and then to the present day with writers like Rob Williams, Al Ewing, Arthur Weyer, Alec Worley, who I think has written Dredd, because we got that wrong, they're grappling with the weight of being that legendary figure in Mega C1, the responsibility of the contradictions that embody, being the law, famously, I am the law, and yet the law being inevitably fallible, and in some cases unfair and cruel and draconian.
Yeah, they really got into it with the I think it was probably inspired by Tiananmen Square and everything, when democracy in the early 90s with America, the America Strip, which is just, I think maybe I'm just old, but I still think that's sort of held up as one of the finest hours of Judge Dredd, the Colin McNeil, John Wagner America Strip, which was one of the ones they did choose to make an audio book of. Like, out of all of the ones they could have done, that was the one they went for, because that was a sweet spot of quite adult but still Judge Dredd. It did, sometimes they take themselves too seriously, comic su superhero type stuff. I don't just mean Dredd, and they get a little bit up their own fundament and they forget their roots. But the sweet spot is when they're a little bit grown up, but they're still Certificate 12, I always say. That's what I always that's and that's what I always think with Doctor Who as well.
Well, I was
Don't get
about to
beyond
say,
don't get beyond Certificate 12, where you're losing the essence of the Hooniverse.
I suppose what I was about to say is, I think, Judge Dredd, Doctor Who, the Sandman comic, and there are probably other examples, they're machines for any story. Oh, this week we're going to tell a story about authoritarianism. Oh, this week we're going to tell a story that is almost, a farce, comedy. Oh, this week we're going to have social commentary. Oh, this week we're just going to have escapism. We're going to have fun. Actually, funnily enough, one of the stories I could have chosen, and it might be divisive for this podcast, was Power of the Doctor. Because I was sat there thinking,
People have chosen that in other episodes.
all right, there's been COVID. There's been a funny thing happening with fandom. I don't plug in too much, but what I'm seeing seems a bit angry. There's a certain angry strand, maybe my age and my gender.
I think it's
And
the permanently online people tend to be more angry anyway.
and I thought just before, I thought, do you know what I need? I need a big birthday cake of an episode. I need what I call prog rock entertainment. Where someone in the band might do a guitar solo, and the drummer goes, that guitar solo doesn't fit, and the guitarist goes, I don't care, it's fun. And that's what Power of the Doctor did for me. I had a
I
massive
love
smile on my face. I was like, this is a guy who's having fun, and I can get behind that. I actually thought he'd read the room really well.
Oh yeah, no, Power of the Doctor was absolutely amazing. Like, it was a sort of new generation's Five Doctors. It was quite silly. The storyline was functional, but like you said, there was so much fun being had, and lots of, and it's weird, everyone says don't do fan service, but I tell you what, my kids who aren't Doctor Who fans got on board when Power of the Doctor, when returning companions were coming. They were like, they loved looking in, they loved going on YouTube and looking at all the stuff that was about to come from the trailers. And they hadn't been interested in Doctor Who since Matt Smith. And suddenly they're watching it again because Ace is coming back, because the Fifth Doctor's going to be there, because they know enough about it. In the same way as that's how they access Star Wars, through its huge lore and its Easter eggs. That's what kids do.
This
Kids love Easter eggs that referencing things that were far before they were born.
a
That's
fun
the modern generation.
yeah a
They love
function
being in on the know, on the lore and
yeah
the mythos of shows.
A
And
function of entertainment is escapism. And if you look at people on a commuter journey after a hard day at work, most of them are reading thrillers. Those pages are turning, those cliffhangers are coming, those surprises, very few of them are reading about the banality of evil and the Ant-Man trials. I
No,
misspoke
not very many.
before. I think I said Alec Worley wrote Judge Dredd, and now I'm not sure of that. That might be wish fulfillment on my part. I should say Alec is one of the new generation of 2080 writers. He's written Warhammer. He's written horror stories for a John Carpenter anthology. He's written all sorts. He's a cracking writer. And in fact, before we properly talk about the choices, if anyone is a fan of British older British comics, he did the most incredible reinvention of Hookjaw, the shark strip, with a really talented artist called, if I pronounce it correctly, Lee Gallagher, who is brilliant and amazing. If you can get hold of that latest iteration of Hookjaw, which was either 2021 or 2022, it was coming out, and I was thinking they're gonna have a real problem with this, because I don't see how you do Hookjaw in the 21st century without being horribly derivative. And they knocked it out of the park.
Yeah.
Really good.
Well, some of the best people in comics, I'm just thinking immediately of Alan Moore and Swamp Thing. They take properties that are unloved and forgotten and breathe new life into them and make them an all-time classic. Because if you've got, I mean, wasn't Sandman already established, or am I getting mixed up? My comic knowledge is poor.
There was a Sandman created by Jack Kirby, who ends up appearing in the Sandman. And so it was kind of around that time of Alan Moore recreating stuff. I don't know if before or afterwards Grant Morrison did a sort of reinvention of Animal Man. Peter Milligan did Shade the Changing Man. And I'm just referencing the writers, apologies to the artists. And the Sandman was taking the name and attaching it to the new concept.
That's where I've got that from then. But anyway,
this isn't a comics podcast, is it?
No, this is not a comics podcast. Although it is run, it is sponsored by Crossway Comics. It's comics adjacent. So
comics adjacent.
And you, some of your choices are comics, but they are Doctor Who comics. So Doctor Who, how important is Doctor Who to young you and old you? Or sorry, adult you, didn't mean old you.
I'm going to be 50 in March.
Well, I'm older than you, so...
It depends which room you're standing in, whether that's old. You know, if I'm standing in the local cancer research shop, I'm young. If I'm in a bar, I'm old. It was between about the time of my first memory of Doctor Who is the Dalek bursting through a wall in...
Destiny
of the Dalek.
Yeah. Scaring Lala
Ward.
And
then it kind of petered round about Colin Baker, because I wanted to like it more than I did. But retrospectively, I think that was just an aging out thing, because I could have easily picked a handful of stories from each doctor. There's no doctor that I don't rate.
Yeah, everyone I've spoken to for this podcast has almost misses a doctor because of the teenage years and becoming a young adult. Yeah. It's like that era is not what Doctor Who is. That's the era that Doctor Who is aimed least at.
Yeah. And then when I was on the Dole, well, I was at college part time and on the Dole, I used to go home with a mate and watch his brother's VHS releases. So it was really important to me in the early to mid 90s. That was what we did. We watched Doctor Who and Blake 7, and they were being steadily re-released. And then, funny enough, for a long time, my doctor was the eighth doctor from the comic strip. And then finally, it's all become something I've shared with my children.
Yeah, you're having children and Doctor Who coming back. It's just been the most magic. It's like the show's been made for you. This thing you loved as a kid. I've said this on this podcast before, I think, but when it first came back, I just kept sort of thinking, oh, I'm in a coma, aren't I? Because this feels, it feels, I'm actually like life on Mars. Because there's no way they brought Doctor Who back and it's like a massive success. That's just silly. That's just something that I would imagine if I was hit by a car and I was lying in hospital. So, but apparently it's real, and this isn't all just some fever dream. But your first, well, the first choice you've gone for is An Unearthly Child. All four of them.
Yeah.
I must admit, this is something, another podcast, I was talking about maybe doing this as my, as a sort of commentary, because I'm such a bad fan. I don't really remember until this week watching the last three episodes. I think I must have done when it was on TV. Did they show all four on TV?
I think I watched it and haven't watched it since, all four, although I've watched the first one since. I think Before I watched it last year again, I hadn't watched it since the Five Faces of Doctor Who season.
Yeah, because I whenever I'm like going, oh, watch the pilot, because I love the pilot is well, the first episode is amazing, but then several minutes into episode two, I always just skip to the Daleks, if I'm doing a sort of rewatch. So bad fan, but yeah, but because of you picking it, I've just this morning finished watching episode four, literally at 9:30. We're recording at 10 a.m. I literally put. Had my breakfast and watched and watched the episode four of Firemaker, and it's I mean the whole thing is just it's really cracking, and you forget how violent it is. I mean that in that episode four, that brutal fight between Cal and Zar with where he gets clubbed to death, it's really violent. I mean, obviously it's off screen, but the implications are very violent,
Well,
but brilliant.
I described to in an email to you those last three episodes of 100,000 BC, is it referred to as Game of Thrones without the sex scene with Kate? I mean, just the bit that always jumps out at me is when he's failing, when the doctor is failing to produce fire. And his mixture of, it's a really nuanced, emotional moment from, and this happens quite a lot in it, from Heartlord, because it's anger as a portmanteau emotion, I think, in that it's anger that is a substitute or masking or an umbrella over fear. And it's just so visceral. And it's full of moment, the scheming of the cave people and the juggling for power and the stakes. It's because it's a society in Michael, isn't it? The
But
stakes of who will lead that society.
I think you forget as well, because you maybe don't appreciate it as a kid, but when you watch it as an adult, and people who I've worked with actors and you've worked with actors, and you just go, some of these supporting actors, you could just tell they're really good. They're just like their performances, they're playing cavemen and grunting and stuff, but even the extras, everyone's doing their job brilliantly, and it's and the writing's really sharp, and and it's got but we kind of, the sort of traditional thing is they had the pilot, no one was really watching, then the Daleks woke everyone up. But I think if those three episodes after the pilot is, we'll call it the pilot because that confuses people. The version that went out, obviously there's the other version that didn't go out, which is known as the pilot. But the episode one and An Earthly Child is perfect television. And the fact it's launched this thing that's still going, because it's, I mean, just that by itself is a brilliant half hour of, I mean, it will go down in the annals of history, because Doctor Who's still going. But the fact it's, you can show that to kids today, and they get, once they've got over the fact it's black and white, it cracks along and they go, oh wow, brilliant, and now they're off on adventures. And
Well,
it's, you could literally watch that and watch modern Doctor Who and not watch anything in between. And
just to go back, one last thing about sort of Game of Thrones with cavemen, but no sex scenes, is also there's a sequence where they're kind of running through the forest, and it's and I sus the actors look a tiny bit amused because presumably they're being wafted. They haven't got much space in that
They had
studio.
to really tight this really tight on people's faces, and they go, oh,
Yeah, they're
waving
being
in their
wafted
hands.
presumably by production people with fronds and leaves and stuff. But I even love that because it's just a reminder of how much Doctor Who traditionally did with so little. The budgets they had, and particularly in those days, because my understanding was it was something like an hour and a half rehearsal. Or
Oh,
was
it
it a
was.
day rehearsal and they shot over an hour and a half? Yeah, it was a day
Yeah.
rehearsal or a week's rehearsal or whatever, but they then shot over it.
Yeah, I think they did like a week, and the end of the week was
Yeah,
recording.
but
Was
that's an
live.
insane way to record it. But going back to what you were saying, the first one, the first episode, An Earthly Child, as it's generally known, it's startling. You could show that in an art house cinema, and if people didn't have preconceptions of Doctor Who, if you showed it to an audience that had never had no notion what Doctor Who was, it would
Yeah.
easily hold its own. Extraordinary.
I had a
It's
conversation
over
not
plate for today.
Yeah, I had a conversation a couple of years ago, and my son was there with Dalek toys, and this in this pub we were in, and the barmaid was from Poland. She had no idea what he was doing, and she was going, "What is this robot?" And then my son, who was really young at the time, was explaining what Daleks were, and she was just going, "So there were things inside." And then we with my phone, we were showing her like what Daleks were, and she was just like, it's like she was just going, "What is this? How have I not? How do I not know what this is?" And then we did start showing her, "Here's the police box, all the basic elements," and you could sort of, so almost like showing her the pilot, just showing her the elements. Someone who literally had no, not even the first bit of knowledge about what this show was, other than it was, is it just a bit like Star Trek? That was literally the only, and no, it's not. It's hardly like Star Trek at all. It's just such a
So
weird show.
I was researching for the podcast, and I came across an article which was talking about the perennial debate: is Doctor Who science fiction or fantasy? To which, of course, the answer is it's stories. That's it. It's stories. The format is so elastic. And actually, something that I'm sometimes a little bit, if I were to level any criticism of Doctor Who kind of as it went on, I think you could even do it without the monsters. It would be really interesting.
My ambition is, if I ever get a chance to write for the show itself, or maybe Big Finish, to do a historical, to just play with the fact that the Doctor expects it to be an alien and it's never an alien. I don't know how you'd have to do something really special to pull that off, because everyone would be expecting an alien.
Well,
Because
we funnily enough, years ago, my sister and I entered for a Big Finish competition, which we didn't win. We got a very nice note saying the idea was, okay. But we did this thing where we did, because they refer to it as faux historical. So it's a his you're in history and then suddenly a monster turns. So we did a faux historical where it was set during the Second World War, and there were these monsters, but then it turned out it was experimental gas, and people were hallucinating the monsters. So, but yeah, I think that would be fantastic. I didn't watch the one, The Witch Hunters. Wasn't that a pure historical?
No, there were aliens
Or were there aliens?
living in Pendle
Oh, okay.
Hill. It
That's the
was
one
weird.
I
It was weird,
missed.
that one, because no, it's very good, but it was weird because it was quite similar to the aliens in Demons of the Punjab, which,
Ah.
so it was almost a bit, it was a bit like when you have the sometimes these things happen with TV. It's a bit like when you had Turn Left, and then you also had Donna having an imaginary thing in Silence in the Library, and it was a bit like, oh shit, you read the writer's tale and Russell's gone, oh bollocks, because they're quite similar and they're quite close together, and it's like, here's Donna again in an imaginary world.
Did I mistitle it? It's the Witch Finders rather than
The
the Witch Hunters.
Witchfinders.
Did I
Oh,
call
so
them the Witch
yeah. Oh, did he
Hunters?
call it the, yeah, no, the Witchfinders, yeah. No. I think that's one of the best of Jodie's era. And so is Demons of the Punjab, and it's just a weird shame when you watch them in order that it's a bit like, these aliens are very similar in their motives, in that they're not bad aliens. They're misunderstood aliens. And
But it's funny that the modern writers are so conscientious and cautious about that, because actually some of the most popular eras of Who, populist, have settled into the rhythm. A rhythm of, oh, it's the master working with the aliens. Or sort of the Hinchcliffe Holmes, great love for them. There are certain tropes, I think, because they were very clever makers of television and they were for a wider audience.
Aliens just always being evil, ugly and evil,
Yeah.
is very reductive, and it's very, it's very entertaining. But
Well,
every so
speak.
often it's nice to have a bit of oh, you think the aliens are bad? No, they're not. That's why
Yeah.
the Silurians are interesting in Pertwee's era
Absolutely.
and all that sort of, it's
Absolutely.
always a bit more interesting.
Free on DVD with issue 6 of Warp Warp. I stopped the car at last and let the fog close in around me.
Brand new animation by Mel.
I knew I was somewhere on Barnes Common, and I had a suspicious idea it was the most deserted part as well.
Adapted from the opening chapter of Doctor Who and the Daleks by David Whittaker.
I'm Barbara. Barbara Wright. Susan. Susan's in the road.
A meeting on the common.
Oh my goodness.
I say, you there! Are you trying to get us all killed? There's petrol everywhere!
Featuring Stephen Noonan.
What are you doing here?
As the First Doctor. Out now. Order online at warpwarp.co.uk.
So, your second choice, if we move on from that, is the Mind Robber. Now, so many people, this is on lots of people's lists. No one I've interviewed, but lots of people say this is amongst the first black and white Doctor Who they ever watched, because it was on during that 1981 that season. Because I remember it being on, and it might possibly be the first Trout one I saw. But why the Mind Robber?
Well, just to pick up your point, it's full of memorable images. Funnily enough, the other day I'm doing a college call, and a guy had a TARDIS drinks container, you know, a sort of drink bottle. I said, "Oh, are you a bit of a fan?" He went, "Not a bit of a fan, well into the classic stuff." And then he was a bit older than me. He started talking about the first one, his first memory of Doctor Who. And it was the unicorn running.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, which one is it? And I said, well, he was trying to grapple with which one it was. And he said about the unicorn running. And I just went, Mind Robber, the Mind Robber. Mm. He was like, yeah. But it's full of those incredible images, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's what you could do the Mind Robber as an audio. But it would be robbed of a certain amount of its power. In fact, let's say you were for some reason it was lost, and you decided to do a version of the Mind Robber on audio from the scripts. I think there would be an argument for saying, well, actually, we're going to do it as a talking book because we need the lyrical descriptions to have those rich visuals. And again, sitcom budget. There's a unicorn putting Jamie's face back together.
Yeah.
What an incredible idea.
And
the thing is, there's so many of them. It's just idea after idea after idea after idea.
I know, it's crazy. And the TARDIS exploding and then rotating and then rotating on the console in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
It's and filmed from quite high above as well.
Mm.
You know, there's that shot and they're tiny in the shot, so I guess they've put a lot of black around them or something later on, but made them smaller than they are.
You know, almost as much as Unearthly Child is all of Who, and you could argue it's not all of Who because it doesn't have the bug-eyed monsters, but actually, bug-eyed monsters is to reduce what the monsters and aliens do, which is that kind of WTF factor of first seeing a Dalek, and I mean first seeing.
Yeah, yeah.
Not knowing what it is and going, what the hell is that? Well, you get that with the TARDIS reveal at the end. And the Mind Robber is almost complementary in that you could almost argue it's a mission statement in that it says anything works, anything goes. It's a journey through story and uninhibit your imagination. And I like sort of, you could say, you know, there was this whole thing years ago. It was either Gareth Roberts or Paul Cornell talked about. Is it Paul Cornell talked about gun versus frog?
Mm-hmm.
The two types of Who, gun versus frog. And so Earthshock perhaps is gun.
Yeah.
You know, and the Mind Robber is frog.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a different approach. And I love Earthshock as much as an X-Man, assuming the X-Man is a child of the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
I adore it. But I do have a real soft spot for the ambition of things like the Mind Robber. You know, in a show that is already ambitious by its very premise that we are going to take a limited budget and we are going to produce a fantastical program, for want of a better word, a piece of weird television in the vein of The Twilight Zone, The Outer Limits, Rittermass, etc., etc. It's incredibly ambitious.
Well, there's another strand of Doctor Who, which is the sort of surreal element. And, you know, it's in Snake Dance, it's in Kinder, it's in...
Oh, absolutely.
It's in whenever they go in The Matrix. It's, I guess, in Heaven Sent, when, for whatever reason, you have the surreal and you have enough of a reason, it's another dimension, that'll do. Because Doctor Who isn't a hard science show. It is not Star Trek, although Star Trek science is all over the place, but it pretends to be hard science when actually it's bollocks. The science is bollocks, but most of the time. But Doctor Who is really in the realm of, I guess, more in common with Star Wars in that stuff just happens, just deal with it. It's, you know, it's not a magic wand, it's a sonic screwdriver, but the science isn't very hard. When the science does happen, the science is based on really, really out there physics, which allow for basically Narnia to happen in your show, to allow for virtually Lord of the Rings to happen in your show. But also anything can happen. You can also then go, you know, Genesis of the Daleks is happening for the next 6 weeks. Strap in. And then you go off and it's the Mind Rubber or it's Snake Dance or, you know, or they're going to be in the Matrix with crazy dentists.
They have the luxury of being able to remake narrative logic is what I see. And again, I'm going to defer to you as a more experienced storyteller, but, you know, so long as, you know, very accomplished people, and there's a link here to the three doctors, we can have, you know, we're going to have the doctor encounter himself and we're going to very firmly establish rules around that, how it happened. It's almost like, I think you were saying that Gareth Kavanagh said about Doctor Who that every story is almost like it could be a pilot.
Yeah, you could have
the Paradise Towers show, or you could have Tales of the Time Lord, or whatever. You know, the three doctors we're going to talk about could have, if it had never been made and they found the scripts, it could be the pilot for the Disney spin-off, Tales of the Time Lord. David Tennant and Matt Smith meet Omega. They're unable to rescue him. Yeah. And then next week we tell a Doctorless story without them. And, we delve into Time Lord history.
Oh, dear. No, no, no. Well, this really isn't good enough. Suffering satellites, I travelled across time and space to face you. And now that I'm here, nothing. Aren't you even going to threaten to exterminate me, you know, with your ray gun sticks? Come along, come along. Can't you poke your eye stalks out of issue 6 of Warp Warp? That's issue 6 of Warp Warp, the acclaimed Doctor Who fanzine, to present me with a bit of daring do. Some excitement, for pity's sake? I guess I can't blame them. I mean, it does celebrate 60 years of an unearthly child with a new interview with Carol Ann Ford, graphic reconstructions of the sets from Doctor Who's very first story, an extensive interview with Mark Gatiss about an adventure in space and time, plus Clive Doig, Brian Hodgson, comic strips, and oh, so much more. Heaven knows how they fit it all in. Do you know, I might take a look myself. Oh, yes. Yes, most exciting. All this plus a free disc containing, among other treats, a dynamic 18-minute animation of a much-loved alternative opening to Doctor Who, as told to David Whittaker in his classic 1964 novelization, Doctor Who in an Exciting Adventure with the Daleks. Oh, I'm sorry. You see, we're all now too engrossed in this super new issue. There'll be no excitements from me or these tin terrors today. No deadly exterminations. Well, you know what they say. All thwop and no slay. Purchase your copy from thwopthwop.co.uk now.
We'll get on to Three Doctors now, then, as your next choice. But just in general, Doctor Who, that pilot episode of it also means, as long as you watch the beginning of the show, or episode one in the old days, you can come on board. This can be your first adventure, and you'll get it. That's a time machine, lands. Somebody gets it, a Doctor and their companion get out, and then you don't really need to know anything else because you're as in the dark as someone who's been watching it since 1963. So That's kind of part of its genius. It forever repeats. It can go anywhere in time and space, and it can go anywhere just about in tone, in storytelling, when Russell brought the show back, how many different tones are there in that? And it still somehow makes sense. It has the empty child. It has the grimness. It has the really hardcore thing at the end. It has Rose in the second episode when the sun blows up, musing that everyone she knows has been dead for 4 billion years. And it has Slovene farting. And it has the Dalek episode with a Dalek committing suicide. All this just as a sort of showcase of what all the different things Doctor Who can be in not actually that many episodes that first season. It's just no wonder it came back and was a success. But it was far from a given.
Yeah, because I'd love them to do a farce. I'd love them to, one of these conceits. You know, they sometimes...
Well, they did Love and Monsters. And
yeah, that's true, actually.
For my money, Love and Monsters is brilliant. I wouldn't like it if... I love Love and Monsters, but if it was every week, I'd probably get a bit tired of it. I'd be like, no, this show's gone really silly now. That would be like the Moffat of Curse of Fatal Death had decided that was where he was going to always pitch the show, in the sort of spoof territory. But just for 1 week, it's brilliant. But also because Love and Monsters, people just remember the silliness and they forget how moving it is, how human it is, how sad it is, with a dead mum at the end. And
it's about, and I've been this guy with my hand on my heart, it's about when someone in the room for their own ends spoils something magical. And it's about fan culture, isn't it? It's about everyone having a lovely, lovely chat in a pub about how much they love Time and the Rani.
Mm.
And someone coming in and sitting down and in a really sneering, horrible way, telling them why Time of the Rani is no Genesis of the Dalek.
Rather than,
do you know what? They're having a great time. I'm going to leave them to it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, I saw it at a con the other day. It was all nice. Everyone's having drinks. And then somebody said they absolutely love the Jodie Whittaker era. And this older fan suddenly went from being nice to, you obviously don't know anything about television then. You obviously don't know anything about writing or story or character. And just attacked this quite young fan verbally. What? And it was horrible. He had to sort of go, will you shut up? It's so stupid what you're saying. You're shouting about a TV show aimed at a family audience that has done really well.
Well, the irony is that the person who didn't know anything about television and stories knew everything you needed to know, which is if you sit down and you're enjoying that story, that's all you need to know. And you can't choose to go deep. But if you're enjoying that story, then fill your boots.
You're winning.
If someone sat next to you grumpily not switching the television off and not enjoying their story, they're the one who doesn't know about stories. Because actually, one of the fundamental things about stories is they're not obligatory. Do not have to watch it.
No, they're not obligatory. But also, just because they're not for you and you maybe would have made different creative decisions, doesn't mean that those creative decisions were wrong. There is no right or wrong, really, because it's a story.
To go back to what you were saying about tone and the tone of Who, one of the reasons I chose this was it's arguably doing what I mentioned before. Like, it's very steady. It's got an incredible cast. It's got a steady producer, Barry Letts. It's got a steady script editor, Terrence Dix. You know, all hands on deck. These guys know how to put out entertaining television.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fun and bombastic and playful and really accessible. And yet, I always come back to that moment where they say, okay, well, we'll try and get you out of sort of the antimatter universe. And Omega takes his helmet off.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a deep moment of existential dread. His self has been, has been extinguished.
Yeah, it's a marvellous...
And that's right, that's like, what's that, 20 past five on Saturday?
Oh, yeah.
Grandstand?
Yeah, Doctor Who does this constantly. It's just, it's the modern show and the old show. I think people that aren't au fait with the classic show are always surprised when they see proper storytelling and things, because they do just think it was shoddily made, running down corridors, fun and camp. And then they watch it and it's like, oh, when the Third Doctor is sad that Joe's leaving and he's sort of alone in the bar, you know, in the pub, and it's like, and they've had all that storyline, you know, so they, you know, we know, but they, you know, they do have characters and emotional development and arcs and all the things that we think of as modern television and modern Who. It's all there in its own way. The way Zoe and Jamie leave at the end of the War Games. Heartbreaking.
Absolutely.
It's just little moments of, what? Can I have my memories erased? Amazing. Brilliant stuff. But yeah, like you said, and the Three Doctors, again, that's from that era of, that probably will be your first. It's from that era. It was same time as The Mind Robber and An Earthly Child.
Ooh.
All three of your...
What have I done unconsciously?
Yeah, all three of your choices are from that era.
I didn't think of that repeat era.
It obviously did something to your brain those few weeks.
Definitely. Watching. And I was very much a committed fan. And I remain a Star Wars Davidson fan. And a converted Colin Baker and Sylvester McCoy fan. Going back to Time of the Rani, which is not on my list, it's been wonderful. My eldest watching some of the episodes that are less well considered. For example, he watched Time in the Rani. It is Time in the Rani, not with McCoy.
The first one, yeah.
Yeah.
McCoy's
and
first
I,
one.
I sort of said to him, I said, not trying to inform, I said, what? He's watching it. I said, what do you think of it? He said, I really like the way he's playing with the character, the Doctor, experimenting. This is brilliant. And I was thinking about it today, and actually, you could draw a parallel between McCoy and Matt Smith and the 11th Hour.
Oh, totally.
That kind of tone of that playful experimentation.
Yeah. Well, I just had to rewatch Time in the Rani for another episode because it was on someone's list.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, I've not watched this since broadcast. And I just remember as a surly teenager going, oh my God. Like, I thought the Colin Baker years were bad and the way he fell down the stairs. And now I watch it and go, teenagers are idiots and they're the last people that should be watching Doctor Who. Because you're basically... I have this thing that I think you become the person you are and then you take a few years off to be a teenager and an early 20s adult, and then you come back to who you are. So you sort of bolster yourself up for 10 years and go, oh, I'm actually cool and I'm actually a teenager and I don't do those things as much anymore and I'm an adult now. And then you get over yourself and you go, oh, I really like Doctor Who. I would still really like Judge Dredd. And in my case, I wish I hadn't said, yeah, Mum, you can take all my 2000 ADs to the tip. I don't mind. From Prog 5 up to God knows when it was.
My God.
From 77 to 85. Yeah, you can take them to the tip. All my magazines, everything. It doesn't matter. I don't need them.
I think there's another developmental stage. And it can happen for people anywhere between the... It's only really recently happened for me in the last few years, and it can happen to people anywhere between the ages of 18 and 80, or for some people you meet, and it's quite sad, it's never happened.
Mm.
And you could call it the never be cruel or cowardly stage.
Mm.
And funny, it's funny hearing about that interaction between two fans you were describing.
Yeah, before. Yeah.
There comes a point where I realized I was seeing far too many interactions in my life as zero-sum interactions, where there needed to be a winner and a loser.
When in fact,
there's no interaction, pretty much, unless you're fighting for the life of a child in court, something like that. And to turn it back round to Doctor Who, you know, the phrase that has been coined, which I think you can live by worse ones, never be cruel or cowardly. I certainly, another episode I could have picked, The Doctor Falls, and I would be picking it for that Capaldi speech.
But it's
basically like, look, we're going to lose.
Yeah,
let's be kind.
Yeah, that last Capaldi season with Pearl Mackey was just some of the best Doctor Who for my money.
It was great.
I was fully back on board with Doctor Who for that.
And I know people criticise, like Moffat's No One Ever Dies.
Mm-hmm.
But it would have ripped out my heart if Bill, too much, if Bill hadn't had some sort of redemptive Phoenix ending, and part of me thinks, why not? It goes back to its telly. I needed the emotion of that more than I needed it to be the right technical choice.
Also narratively, if what he put her through, she had a big hole shot through her, and then she got turned into a Cyberman. So he wrote himself into a real corner, because all that's brilliant, and it's horrible, and it was like a horror movie. The Doctor's companion is a Cyberman, and her body has been put in the bin. So it's horrible to then go, to then have an ending where he goes, well, there's nothing I can do except kill you, and you can be released. Then that would be too much.
Because actually, I can't believe it hasn't occurred to me. Perhaps because of the redemptive hand wave. But if he hadn't have done that, it would have been frigid. It would have been Green Lantern finds his girlfriend in the fridge.
It would have
been frigid, which is just a terrible, terrible trap. But you see, it's fascinating, isn't it? The family show, the deaths it's got, why it prompts so much conversation. That's a couple of episodes.
What he did with the Cybermen in that episode was just, they were as scary as they had been in this. I've never liked the Cybermen, except after the Pertwee years, I'm never that bothered by the Cybermen. Yeah. They're all right, but they're a bit silly. What he did with that thing, making them really horrible people in medical gowns and a bit of a cloth mask, and they're the sort of ghost of gas burn victims from World War One. They've got, you know, like the Daleks of the Nazis. The Daleks of the Nazis and the fear of nuclear holocaust in a kids program. The Cybermen always remind me of gas masks and burn victims from the Somme. And I think he sort of tapped right back into that horrible medical industrialized slaughter Cybermen first came from.
I suppose the thing is, in the 10th planet, the Cybermen are meditation, and perhaps the term hadn't even been coined then, on transhumanism.
Mm-hmm.
And if we continue, I shouldn't say start, because you're wearing glasses and I've got feelings, but if we continue to modify ourselves medically, like Theseus's boat, I think it is. Is it Theseus's boat? At what point do we replace ourselves so much that we lose what makes us human?
I mentioned Trigger again. It's Trigger's broom, isn't it?
Which is like Trigger's broom, which is I suppose. taking what you were talking about, the oppositional nature of creating a villain for a character, if we see the Doctor as an alien who has learned to be more human, the good parts of being human by his companion's example, and thus is a humanist, then it makes perfect sense to ask the question of how could we lose that?
Mm-hmm.
And probably that is a core of, if not all, many episodes of Doctor Who. The villains are perhaps it would be better, rather than say humanity, Davros is willing to subjugate his sense of self to power and control. You know, that famously he would extinguish all life in the universe, presumably including his own, simply to have the power to extinguish all life in the universe.
Yeah. Well, as we find out, because that idea is followed all the way on by Russell T. Davis to the reality bomb, which is the ultimate expression of that, is not to kill himself, but to kill everything that's ever in every multiverse, apart from a little pocket where it's him and the Daleks pointlessly living. That's the ultimate extension of what started in Genesis of the Daleks.
You're listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Comics, publisher of creator-owned comics based on characters and stories set in the Doctor Who universe. For more on Cutaway, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe.
So your final two choices are both bringing us back to the world of comics, but comics that are Doctor Who. Your first one, this has also been chosen by Adrian Salmon
really?
and Gareth Cavanagh. in the first ever bunker. So we have Black Legacy by Alan Moore and David Lloyd, and a very, I almost think of pre-canon era Doctor Who.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't write a story like this now, because all the writers would be told, no, Cybermen don't do this, and Cybermen aren't like that.
Yeah.
This was a little bit more of the Wild West of spin-off material, which is, I'd say, one of the reasons it's so good and so amazing. So just introduce Black Legacy to us, well, for anyone who doesn't know.
I want to be somewhat circumspect about it, because it's available in the Essential Cybermen store. So you should go out and read it.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
It's 8 pages. It's 4 2-page episodes. It's very much in the format of Twist in the Town. The Cybermen arrive on a planet to investigate that was the home of these armorers, these weapons makers. And they're investigating that.
Yeah, and the Death Smiths of Goth.
Yeah, and then things aren't quite what they seem, because it seems there is something stalking the Cybermen. And it's atmospheric, it's punchy, and it reminds us that good things come in small packages, and of relevance to Cutaway Comics and to the comics collections that Panini bring out and the Daleks collection, etc., etc. It reminds us of how the idea of Doctor Who and the associated worlds, because there's no Doctor in it, can transcend format. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's early work by Alan Moore, relatively early work by David Moore. But it's just a fantastic piece of storytelling. And if I were Russell T. Davis, I'd get a really top-flight writer and I'd say to them, right, read this. We're going to do a Doctorless episode.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're going to dramatize this, make the Cybermen more Cybermen, because they are a little bit out of character.
Yeah.
And then the twist at the end is the TARDIS is going to appear, and we'll do a second episode carrying on with it, with the Doctor investigating what happened. It's fantastic. And I'm realizing as I'm talking about it, one of the difficulties is I don't want to spoil anything about it.
No, it's definitely worth reading, because it's been reprinted recently. People should go and buy it.
What does it make you think, as someone who's involved in Doctorless comics, about their potential?
Well, I mean, I think coming back to what Gareth always says about virtually every episode being a pilot, because they invent an entire world, each adventure, and that world is more often than not rich enough that you could imagine what happens without the Doctor. But also, I think one of the things on Paradise Towers is this, and the Sunmakers, you know, so many times the Doctor comes and foments revolution. When he's there, he's so often overturned a tyrannical regime. Things are technically better than they were when we first arrived, but you can also see the Doctor hasn't got to deal with the fallout from, toppling a dictator, which, as we know in real life, sometimes leads to all manner of civil wars and power vacuums and all the rest of that. But in terms of Black Legacy, it sort of shows that the characters involved are, and the monsters that are created, are perfectly capable of existing without the Doctor as an enemy. I mean, the early iterations seem really weird to us. The same as with the TB-21 Daleks.
Mm-hmm.
They're a lot more, I was going to say human for a shortcut, but they've got a lot more going on, and they have like a culture, and Terry Nation tried to like give them a weird glossary of language and stuff, and the Daleks became a much more, they are just little machines filled with hate. Kind of the essence of what a Dalek is got sort of sorted out quite quickly, but early on in the early 60s there were a lot more an alien race that thought and did things and weren't emotionless. And it's a bit like that with Alan Moore's sort of approach to the Cybermen. It's because at the time of writing, I don't think he'd, you know, it's not like he had a DVD or a VHS even of an old Cyberman episode to watch. He hadn't watched the Cybermen since he was a child. So he just sort of had, well, they're machine men, aren't they? And they're very violent and obsessed with war. But you wouldn't write the Cybermen like that now.
Well,
But to be honest, they're not that, you know, they're still the Cybermen. They are a little bit unlike the Cybermen we know.
Well, he's been interviewed, hasn't he, for Warp Warp. He was in issue 3, and there's quite... And I'm pretty sure... I've actually got it in my hands right now, and I'm trying to find the quote, but I'm sure he said he's sort of a... Here we go. As I understand it, the main part of the Cybermen ethos was efficiency and a kind of hygiene. So it's a sort of... That's a pull quote. And he takes it from there. You know,
And that's why, and if you go from that point of view, then the worst thing that can happen to them is madness and death and disease, which is kind of what happens. But yeah, I think watching a bunch of Cybermen be wiped out bit by bit on TV, it might be difficult to sustain that with modern Cybermen. It might be difficult to sustain that for 45 minutes of television without any humans whatsoever.
Just to quote the interview as well, he says physical and mental disease will be completely unknown to the Cybermen. So I thought, what if there was something that could reintroduce these forgotten terrors to this race that has gone beyond the fear of mental and physical illness?
Yeah. Well, I suppose what you can do, if you were to make this into a TV series, is you'd find Cybermen with their emotions coming back, especially their fear and their terror. Yeah.
And maybe you'd have some stranded humans as well. Throw some...
Yeah.
Do a, what's it called? Death to the Daleks.
Yeah, where you have
some stranded humans in there.
Yeah, yeah. Or various space travellers. Or you could have the TARDIS as they try and, as the Deathsmiths of Goth, as the, what's it called? The weapon. Almost like the moment, isn't it?
From,
it's sort of a sentient weapon.
So when you guys are cutaways, for example, you work on Omega, presumably there's a period of where you explore that potential. You explore kind of the moment beyond the television show in the background.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously we can't mention the TV show, but we've got rights to Omega. And in our heads we kind of know, and you just get that from reading it, Omega's ultimate destination is, well, in the Three Doctors, is to discover he's got no form at all. He's literally just will now. Which again is fantasy, going back to what you're saying. That's a fantasy idea. That's not based in any kind of science whatsoever. That's that being held together by will is a very, that's Sauron in Lord of the Rings or something. But it's the tone of Doctor Who. It's perfectly fine. And then ultimately, whatever it is that happens through an Arc of Infinity, which is, it's been a long time since I've watched that. But he ends up sort of hearing some music when he looks a bit like Peter Davison near the end and things. But he's hardly got any power left whatsoever at the end of that. So in this one, he's still got physical form. So that's kind of the thing. But he can't exist. We sort of meet him. We find out he can't exist in the real universe when he escapes from his without wearing Dwarf Star armor, which we're allowed to use because Stephen Gallagher's also involved. So that's our Omega is. In this universe, he's just escaped, but he has to wear a big suit of armor, which looks really cool. So that's kind of where we are with Omega.
It sounds almost like the Marvel Cosmic Comic, Galactus and Adam Warlock and all that.
Yeah, well, it was is it Knights of Infinity? Are they called? It was a great big that Gareth's sort of main impetus for it was Sutekh and Omega fighting in armor on the side of a mountain, and that's kind of going to happen. It's now a volcano that's going to happen. And it was from these sort of, I think it was Marvel, great big people. They look a lot like Brian Blessed as well. They're great big warriors dressed like medieval knights, but in a science fiction setting. So that's kind of where, one element of where the Gods and Monsters is going. So it's but anyway, I'm here to interview you. That's cool. That's cool.
To the side, cool. Because it's Adrian Salmon.
Well, yeah, and obviously we've Sutekh. I got to work with Adrian Salmon, who I've been a fan of for probably as long as you have, since knowing his name from this very strip, your last choice, the Cybermen strip from 31 years ago.
Yeah,
can you believe it? So tell us a little bit about the Cybermen strip. Doctor Who monthly.
As a child of 2000 AD, I'm a sucker for episodic storytelling. As someone who appeared at Dan Dare when I was a child and also latterly enjoyed the Dalek strip, I'm actually a sucker for two-page episodes and one-page episodes. I love love brevity. I love the propulsive nature it brings to comics. Mm-hmm. And the fact that comics have an infinite budget. You know, mm-hmm. whatever Alan Barnes, writer, and Adrian Salmon could imagine, they had the budget for. And they mm-hmm. used it. There's a massive time jump at one. Mm-hmm. There's people riding, I say people, Simon, Silurians and stuff, riding mm-hmm. dinosaurs. There's, you know, there's a hammer. It's is it the most 2000 AD Doctor Who adjacent strip ever? Possibly. To go full circle, having discussed, you know, it's like they have hammer horror in there.
Yeah, well, I think Absalom Dak as well is very sort of Han Solo with 2000 AD sort of DNA as well. But I know what you mean. I mean, 2000 AD is basically a massive influence on, you know, well, from Des Skin to Warrior Magazine to 2000 AD, that was British comics. And that sort of inevitably sort of fed into those, that era of Doctor Who comics. And the fact that you had Pat Mills and people also writing, John Wagner as well, writing the strip, which, to bring it right up to date, you know, Star Beast, the storyline being used by Russell in the TV episode with the 14th Doctor and Donna, Beep the Meep, and all manner of things from that era.
It's also a reminder of how fertile the wilderness is. And I sometimes think one of the things, again, as someone who's worked in television, you know, one of the things that Doctor really benefited from was let's get this right. Before they started production in 2003, I think it was a 14-year pre-production period in terms of random idea generation and design.
Yeah, yeah.
On the new adventures from the comic strip, from, you know, how many Time Wars have there been? I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, this think one in particular, this, but it, that is sort of to damn it with faint praise, because actually, again, to go full circle, like Unearthly Child, this could stand on its own. If you magically mm-hmm. erase the rest of Doctor Who history, this would stand as a fantastic, absolutely crazy idea gem with art that you could hang in a gallery.
Oh, yeah.
Lettering, hang in a gallery, and people would be blown away.
Yeah, Adrian's art's just something else. I mean, there must be someone out there, like the Polish barmaid I was talking about, who has no awareness of Doctor Who will pick up the Cybermen. We sold a comic at the BFI the other day, mm-hmm. and it was a Doctor Who event, but there was a kid there who'd just come in with his parents, and they were just having a day weekend break in London, and would wandered into the BFI, and they didn't really know what Doctor Who was. And the kids certainly didn't, because they just weren't interested in it. They were 10, and Doctor Who isn't what most 10-year-olds are into these days, and I think that will change quite soon. But right now, my son is very much the only Doctor Who fan in his whole school, I think, and that's where we are. But yeah, so this kid bought a Stephen Gallagher Tharyl comic, because I mentioned that there was a sort of Jack Kirby thing in some of the flashback scenes are done as a sort of homage to Jack Kirby, and because he knew his comics and his DC and his Marvel, he went, oh, I'll have that. So his first introduction to the Whoniverse is going to be a cutaway comics about the Tharyls, written by Stephen Gallagher with art by Martin Geraghty, which I just love to like find it, because he sat there reading it saying, I love this, it's brilliant, and so he sat there and read the whole thing.
But it shows just the power, like you say, of the concept.
Yeah, yeah, but the power, he doesn't know who the Doctor is.
So
he literally doesn't know what the show is. But that spin-off entertained him, and who knows where it's going to lead in terms of buying more cutaway stuff. Who knows?
On the Adrian Salmon front, he's doing mm-hmm. Sutek.
Yeah, yeah.
And who's writing that?
Oh, that's just come out. So we'll have to send you have you not had a copy? We'll send you a digital file of that. Oh no, it's brilliant. No, I wrote that, and it's had some nice reviews. So which is all good. But yeah, but the Cybermen by Adrian Salmon and Alan Barnes, I mean, Adrian said himself that it's sort of inspired by the TV21 Dalek strip, so it's kind of, it's sort of basic idea was to sort of do for Cybermen what they did in the 60s for with the TV21 Daleks, and that's kind of what it does, isn't it? It's absolutely fantastic, kind of, and no, and like you say, no need for the Doctor.
And like the Mind Romber, it's just it's almost like an homage to the act of, even before stories, of simply the joy of ideas. It is so propulsive. It is so packed with ideas. It's, you know, it's, I heartily recommend it to anyone. Again, it's in the Essential Simon collection, I think. So you can pick that up, and that's something like £30 for 350 pages or something. No, it's like 26 quid or something.
Yeah, no, this, so it's, yeah, because it's a big Cybermen collection, isn't it, that's got the Cybermen strip, but also things like Black Legacy. Are they in the same tome?
Yeah, and the Flood. Yeah, yeah. The Flood.
And the Flood,
I could easily have chosen. Really,
yeah.
Fact, you know, you could argue, did I say this before? You could argue that the Cybermen were better, have been better served in comic strips than on television. Because I think they had that original conception in the 10th Planet, and then they sort of became sort of, they're almost like ghosts or zombies in the trailer. The way they sort of float about mostly and hurry. They're almost like, or maybe like a gang of slashers from a slasher film.
Yeah.
Hide in the background in a bit.
Yeah, no, I mean, the thing I always think of is Junkyard Demon with, the Mick McMahon Cybermen.
Mm.
Just, you know, which was a big influence on Adrian. I think when I interviewed him for this, that was one of his choices, because Mick McMahon's kind of his favourite artist, you know, from childhood to present day kind of thing. And you can sort of see that in his own sort of brilliantly compelling abstract style. And we're absolutely delighted to, I mean, have his work on Sutek and our Orsini comic is just absolutely brilliant. And he's now about to embark on a Happiness Patrol, which is...
Oh, wow.
Adrian Salmon does Happiness Patrol. It's going to be wonderful. But that, the way comics move, that will probably be out in 2024, if not 2025. But yes, at time of recording. Anyway, we have been nattering for ages, but that's brilliant. And thanks so much for your choices, and for being on the podcast, and all your support of Cutaway. So I'm looking forward to seeing the thing up on downthetubes.net, which for people listening to this, it will already be up there. But for me, it lies slightly in the future by a few days, I think.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. But that's been fantastic. But yeah, enjoy the rest of your day. Yeah.
You've been listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Universe. Your host has been Ian Winterton, produced by Jane Stevenson of Bamalan Productions. Gods and Monsters advert voiced by Brian Blessed. All music by Paul Phillips. For more on Cutaway and to buy online, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe.